I'm very happy now to welcome Paul Valdick. He is chairman and CEO of the High Lonesome Ranch in Colorado. He's on the board of the Western Landowners Alliance. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. We're talking to a lot of people who are landowners, who are ranchers, who have become very concerned with conservation over the years and seeing their land as an ecosystem and as part of a larger ecosystem. And that's something that you are very involved in. Tell us about how you got there. I mean, you started out as a kid who went to college on a basketball scholarship. You went to law school. You were a trial lawyer. How did you start this path of conservation?
Well, it was a process, and I think it's been a growth and learning experience, a maturation process along the trail. Basically, I found myself, after starting to acquire ranches in western central Colorado, owning a landscape the size of some of our national parks, and not having the background and experience to manage that and leave that landscape better than I found it and to improve and conserve it, and to also recreate and to provide jobs on that landscape. So I became involved in a variety of conservation organizations, the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, Trout Unlimited, the Wildlands Network, and the Boone and Crockett Club. I'm one of the 100 regular members of that club, founded by Theodore Roosevelt in 1887. Through those organizations and good people working on the ground, on many of them, and board members have been working in wildlife and conservation and landscape scale conservation for years, and the scientists involved with many of them, I really learned how little I knew and how important it was to not only have great, hardworking people on my landscape that knew my landscape, but to provide them interaction with professionals that had had more time in science and other endeavors so that we could apply best practices to the landscape.
So the various organizations that you were involved with, there's so many different kinds of conservation organizations. You have characterized it as sort of right to left in character.
Maybe it is a little politically tied, and you see in some of the organizations, I would say that the Boone and Crockett Club is probably right of the Sierra Club, not as in right or wrong, but more politically leaning. And I think across that spectrum, we see people that care about landscapes and wildlife and healthy ecosystems and a biodiverse region. Across those boards and across the great associates and staff working on them are people trying to accomplish great goals. For instance, the National Turkey Federation has had to change their mission because they've restored turkeys to North America in a variety. And wouldn't it be great if Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, and Trout Unlimited and others had finished and had achieved their goals and mission?
That's an amazing story. You have an organization whose mission is to restore wild turkeys to landscapes in all 50 states, and they do.
Right. I mean, that's great. That's not a board I've served on, but it's a great organization I'm familiar with. And, you know, if you define your mission and you set a path to achieve it, I think that NGO has shown us that missions can be accomplished. And, you know, they're now working on habitat. But in my opinion, when you look at a variety of organizations, most of it does come back to habitat, whether you're talking about the Sierra Club or the Nature Conservancy or more species-based organizations. Some people call them the hook and bullet organizations. Whether it's trout or elk or mule deer and those organizations that work so hard to support those missions.
Hook and bullet meaning hunting and fishing.
Yes.
So there are some conservation folks who are interested in conservation so that habitats remain where they can hunt and fish, and others are about ecosystems or about preserving species who have no interest whatsoever in hunting and fishing.
Well, I mean, I think that's true, and they're all good missions. I think if you look historically at things from the taxes levied and the dollars donated and the funds generated from hunting and fishing licenses, most habitat conservation, I believe, has been accomplished through sportsmen.
Now, there are so many issues that we're talking about quite a lot these days about connectivity. Our lands, whatever land a person owns, has a fence around it or has a border around it, but animals and birds don't have borders, and they don't want borders, and they don't recognize fences. They have to get from point A to point B. And so the issue of connectivity becomes very important as humans use more and more of the land in a way that's not really compatible with animals. A lot of conservation has historically focused on public land. Now there's this whole issue that you've been very involved with of looking at maps and seeing, okay, what's public land, what's private land, how can we work together?
Well, and as a Texan, there's very little federal land in Texas. So whether it was the ranches I owned or leased in South Texas and Central Texas, you had no interaction with the federal government and agencies. There was no, except for Big Bend and Far West Texas, there's very little federal land in Texas. So I didn't have any prior experience with the Forest Service or the Department of Interior and the BLM. And as I acquired ranches and lands in Colorado, those turned out to be my neighbors and not folks that I knew their phone number that just lived across the fence. They had agencies and offices close, but, you know, their head and control was in Washington, D.C., which was a whole new genre for me to address and learn to deal with.
Now, you were acquiring ranches. What was the purpose of that? I mean, that was your business?
No, I had practiced law for 30 years, and I thought 30 years doing the same thing was too great of a percentage of a lifetime to do the same thing. My trial work, both as a defense lawyer and a plaintiff's lawyer, can be confrontational and stressful and, you know, not unlike many of our lives. But it was time to do something else, and I've always loved the outdoors and wildlife and sporting tasks and recreation, and I had dreamed, probably like many folks, about having a place where I could share a glass of wine and have a steak and have friends and enjoy a ranch. My college roommate and myself had decided that if one of us ever got a ranch, the other one could come visit, and I just happened to get the first one. And although he's been to visit, I've had very little time as the ranches grew and expanded, and my sense of obligation, or as a legal term, a fiduciary duty to the landscape, continued to grow. And so most of my time on the ranch is either within our businesses and our multiple use, which I think is hugely important for a landscape and the communities and people that are around those working lands. He still visits, but I have probably too many meetings a year through either conservation groups and boards or our work. At High Lonesome Ranches, we're working on a model energy project of 287,000 acres that we're going to put conservation first and energy development and keeping the ranch together and the income from that as a secondary goal. We're also working on a 17-mile valley-wide restoration in the Kimball Creek Valley. And those projects and the meetings and the planning for that and the fundraising for that really consume a lot of my time.
We're talking to Paul Valdick of the High Lonesome Ranch. How did you first come to work with other landowners on conservation issues?
Well, again, I was a Texan and was lost and was out of my professional development arena, and I thought that I wouldn't have as steep of a learning curve as if I surrounded myself with other ranchers, other conservationists and NGO organizations, and also, and I think I left that out earlier, universities. We've at High Lonesome Ranches, we've been working with a variety of land grant and really some of the most prominent universities in the United States. But as I acquired the ranches and our deeded and permitted lands are now around 402 square miles, I think. That sense of obligation and understanding continued to grow in me. And to be able to interact with federal agencies, I thought that to form, it was one of my bases, to provide a group of landowners that could share information. But my initial thoughts for, I think the reason we're here today and chatting, is the Western Landowners Alliance. And our executive director and our headquarters is in Santa Fe. And I was at a meeting in Santa Cruz, California, invited, I think E.O. Wilson was hosting along with Michael Soleil. I think those gentlemen are kind of known as the fathers of conservation biology, and really large landscape scale connectivity thinking. And it's very important to me that the landscape I've been fortunate enough to be a steward of and caretaker of not be subdivided, and to lose that connectivity question on its landscape. And I attended this meeting with a lot of other conservation environmental organizations, and I think there were members there from all the way from the Humane Society, the Sierra Club, to Trout Unlimited. And here I was in this meeting. I'm a rancher. I've got oil and gas interest, and I've got a hunting and fishing background and recreational interest. I might not have been probably the prototypical person invited to this meeting, but I listened for a couple days and noticed that they had a wonderful map on the wall and great vision of showing somehow connected, integrated landscapes running from the mountains in Mexico basically to the Arctic. And on one hand, I thought, what great vision. On the other hand, that might not happen for 200 years if anybody could figure it out, and was I wasting my time here? And many members of this group really hadn't communicated well before. They, you know, one of them might be working in a valley and the other group not even know. So there hadn't been a lot of coordination. And I think Mr. Soleil's idea to bring this Congress or group together was to bring more coordination to that environmental organization, what I'd call left of the aisle folks, and invite some more of the centrist of the Trout Unlimiteds and the CCAs to the meeting. And with my background on many of what I would call the hook and bullet club boards or organizations, they had formed the American Wildlife Conservation Partners. A Boone and Crockett member, I think Dan Pedrotti, was very instrumental in that. And that side of the aisle had been working together for a number of years and signing on and off on letters as a group, where this other more environmental side of conservation hadn't had that degree of cooperation and communication. And I was glad to attend this meeting and see this. And when I looked on the map, I think it was 6,000 miles of map, and I thought, well, you know, the federal government doesn't have the funds, even if they were so inclined by eminent domain or whatever, to connect these disjointed landscapes now. And you could see islands of public lands, whether it was Glacier National Park or Yellowstone, where we're all familiar with, or whether it was BLM lands and multiple use lands, our national forest lands, they weren't connected. They were islands. And, you know, I think most of us, your listeners, or, you know, have some understanding that if you're an island genetically or whatever, you're not probably healthy. So as Soleil and E.O. Wilson and others talked about connectivity and migration patterns and even climate change, you know, and that's not just critters or other flora and fauna migrating north or south, it's also in elevation as climate changes and or the impacts become more drastic. And I thought, I was sitting looking at the map, and I'm a butcher's son from Houston, Texas. It needed, as you mentioned, a scholarship to go to college. And I looked at this map and I thought, oh my goodness, these ranches that I've acquired, the High Lonesome Ranches and the Kbartee Ranch in Meeker, my goodness, they're a quarter. They might even be a 50-cent piece on this map. And if somebody with my background was able to acquire that kind of landscape, and much of it is involved with BLM lands and other neighboring federal lands, well, then how many other folks that are older, more successful, inherited, whatever the situation was, how many other ranches were out there that could be nickels, dimes, and quarters, or even silver dollars on that map? And my goodness, if we connected these ranches in some sort of organization that where we all shared some common goals and operating procedures about wildlife, whether it be ranching or human recreation or mineral extraction and development, and had some shared standards and shared information, these islands of Yellowstone and others, these private lands, could be highways and pathways for connectivity. And I think the Michael Soleys and Jim Estes and John Torborgs of the world had come to believe that for wildlife, it wasn't just about public lands anymore. When you looked at the maps and understood the private lands owned so much of the water rights, the really great habitat that was homesteaded decades, 100 plus years ago, and that it was integral for these public lands to be better connected and associated with private lands.
So what happened next?
Well, I left that meeting and had continued, and I do serve on the Wildlands Network board, and had talked to our executive director and other board members about the need to bring other like-minded ranchers in that that cared about biodiverse, healthy working landscapes, the kind of message that Aldo Leopold delivered a long time ago in Sand County Almanac about the health of a whole mountain. I had been, for much of my life, probably a single species person about, I wanted lots of elk, or I wanted fish or something. But as valuable as those might be to the landscape and the enjoyment and the beauty of it, really the health of the whole ecosystem, or as Aldo Leopold would say, the health of the whole healthy mountain, is obviously more important. So I do believe in our Western Landowners group that we started to form from that meeting and build with other ranchers. I would kind of put us somewhere, we share many of the goals and values of farming and ranching communities and organizations, and we share many goals of organizations you might put on the other side of the scale, from the Nature Conservancies and the Sierra Club, and we're probably in some middle ground in between those, and trying to find a place for common dialogue and improvement of landscapes and the communities that they border.
So how much overlap is there? I mean, would you say that your interests are very similar, the Sierra Club, let's say, and the people who are doing ecological ranching like you are?
Well, I wouldn't want to or try to speak for any of the organizations, but I would suspect that we all care about healthy forest, clean water, wildlife, and the maintenance of that habitat and landscapes for future generations. And I think from just observing that, those main goals are shared, if you want to say 80%, within all of these organizations. And I think the question is, how do we have that come together dialogue to work more on what we agree on, instead of going to the corners and not accomplishing any goals by we're in our corners locked in some fight by the 20% that we might not agree on.
We're talking to rancher Paul Valdick. What is the role of science in the work that you're doing?
Well, I'm in the process of trying to raise the funding, and we hope to complete that task in the next 2 years of building the High Lonesome Institute. We've done considerable science work, starting out with Christina Eisenberg, who wrote The Wolf's Tooth and other books and does great work. And she got her PhD from OSU. And my first institute director was Hal Salwasser, who had a background with the Forest Service at their highest levels and ended up as Dean of Oregon State. And was instrumental in many of the chairs and support to universities provided through the Boone and Crockett Club. And unfortunately, Dr. Salwasser passed away within about the last month or so, and we have initiated a process to replace my institute director. We will build a bricks and mortar institute once I've completed the fundraising. And my hope and goal of that is there are other institutes that work with the universities for science in regional areas, such as the Clayburgh Institute in South Texas, or the Joseph Jones or Tall Timber institutes in Georgia, in the Southeast and the Pines, or the Adirondack. But to my knowledge, there's not really a institute doing applied science work applicable to working multiple-use type landscapes. And we've had a great interest. With High Lonesome Ranch, I think we have more ecological zones than any national park. I think we start at high desert and go all the way to subalpine, and we've got a full slate of, I'd say, critters on the ranch. You know, I joke like root beer, A to W, but it's antelopes to wolves and everything in between. I think the opportunity to study in these universities do work, one where they can contract long term and know these study areas can by contract be committed to. And have a place to do science on working lands and not just public lands. We've got a lot of interest from a variety of universities to come to High Lonesome and the Institute, which will be a totally separate entity, to do that science. And I hope the science can then be applied to our landscape, or what I'd call the outdoor laboratory, to see if the science really does work in place. And I hope that will be shared with other ranchers and farmers and conservationists and groups interested up and down what Michael Soulet would call the spine of the continent, and Intermountain West.
The spine of the continent being basically the Rocky Mountain chain going from really New Mexico to Canada.
Right. And, you know, our friends at Y to Y are Yellowstone to Yukon and others, the landscape and the federal and private interaction of lands in the West, I think, is of critical importance. You know, we humans, we're here, and we like being in beautiful places. So people are going to have communities. So what is the balance as our population grows and there's more and more folks, and especially with all of the IT and growth and software and everything, many of us being able to work in pretty places instead of in downtown urban settings. So how do we have that connectivity and those landscapes conserved and not turned into fragmented subdivisions? And what's the balance, and how do we plan for a future that involve both of those goals that are necessary?
What are some of the areas that you are studying and hope to study in this institute that is using private lands as a laboratory for science? Like, what are some of the specific areas?
Well, the areas we're studying, and again, it's not only our private lands, it's our BLM permitted lands and other federal lands. Our areas of study, and I think these are two of the main ones that I believe are critical to the entire Intermountain West, or that spine of the continent you've mentioned. I think number one, and I'll even put that ahead of water, is oil and gas, because it's here now. It's been leased by our government and the mineral rights on that for some decades. and is happening on the landscape right now. To some degree, in my mind, water's kind of what it is and where it's going to go, and certainly important. Maybe they're just both number ones. But our institute and our ranch, we're currently working on, I think I mentioned it earlier, 287,000 acre model energy project, where we're looking at, and again, here we are, water issues involved with that extraction of in our area, in case it's gas, the roads and all of the things. We're trying to do the planning in advance, where the companies will know what business they have, where they are or aren't drilling, independent of what the mineral rights are, and what the permitting will be, and without litigation. And then on our interest on that front end of conservation, as we look at how that might impact mule deer, elk, sage grouse, leopard frogs, a whole variety of things, or any erosional processes. We've spent 2 years working, and we've got a group, 30 working partner group, and I think that's everybody from the sage grouse sides to major energy company, sitting at a table and having dialogue to say, how can we develop energy and keep dollars in America? How can a family ranch be held together and pay estate or death taxes, or pay the people working on it through that mineral production? But yet, how can we conserve its conservation values for future generations and make sure we don't damage that? And, you know, if I can use 2% of the land, or 5%, whatever it is, to save 95%, because I'm not a rich guy, then I think I've accomplished a pretty good mission that I otherwise wouldn't be able to even address or accomplish. Now, at High Lonesome, we do ranching. We're a cow-calf operation. We work with the Lynch family, and we're very, very involved in our cattle business, our grazing. We, at some time in some valleys, might have bison. As we get to that and complete some of our stream and valley restoration projects. But I fully believe in an integrated working multiple-use landscape of minerals, grazing, and human recreation. Our biologists have compiled birding lists. We're an ecotone. We've got overlapping desert and mountain birds, birds of prey, and a lot of waterfowl. And so, you know, you could be fly fishing at our ranch and birding at the same time, or horseback riding, or having a cooking lesson or a spa type experience, but the outdoors are there. You can be biking. We do big game hunting. It's one of our major revenue sources, but we, and everything conservation's at the front. We take a lot less from the land, whether it's fishing or hunting or biking, than it can heal itself or put back every year.
So you are talking about doing basically ecologically responsible gas drilling. So far, I mean, we've seen the many ways in which oil and gas have devastated landscapes and really hurt landscapes, and the dangers to drinking water and all of that. Are there, in your experience, examples of best practices where it's actually not devastating landscapes?
I don't mean to be critical of anyone's work or side, but it's our goal here in Colorado not to repeat what I would think are some of the mistakes or the rush to production in Wyoming. I think ranches such as Ted Turner's Vermejo Park started an effort to do responsible energy development. Does energy impact a landscape? Heck yes. But how can it have the least impact and accomplish the goals necessary? I look at the King Ranch. Here are people that invented the quarter horse, won a Triple Crown in the 30s, have some of the best wild quail hunting and white-tailed deer hunting in the world. And I don't think that ranch would be together today if Humble Oil hadn't discovered minerals on it decades ago. and they've instituted all kinds of ecological practices. So I would point is the King Ranch is a healthy landscape. They're one of the great wintering places for birds, I think, in the world. And energy has provided a way to allow the heirs to not end up subdividing that landscape. So I guess I go back, and I think Sam Gary in Colorado and Terry Minger started Colorado Open Lands in the 80s along with some other folks, and I think that board still exists, and I have a few friends on it, where they found landscapes, and they developed 5 or 10% of it to pay for saving 90%. And, you know, here in Colorado, we've got to be a working landscape. If I just closed it and tried to make it a preserve of some sort, you could lose the water rights associated with the land. And to conserve your water rights, you have to have a farmer and a tractor and fuel and insurance and a crop and something going that you've historically tracked and irrigated. So something's got to pay for that. You know, I guess in an ideal world, somehow we could just fence my landscape and not do anything on it. Maybe it'd be a great, wonderful place, but I don't think that's much existed since Adam and Eve. So I think the real question for us that care about doing the right thing is what level of taking can we do from a land where it's not damaged, where it doesn't heal itself every year, that we don't take too much. And I think in our oil and gas project, we're really looking really hard at how we can use those funds to better improve sage-grouse habitat. I think along with sage-grouse comes better improved mule deer habitat. I think our human experiences, if you see a gas well that once the drilling rig is gone is pretty innocuous, as long as that pad and other stuff is reclaimed. I think it's part of our story that is one of our working uses on the landscape that's allowing the rest of this to be here.
We're talking to Paul Valdik, chairman of the High Lonesome Ranch in Colorado. So going back to that moment where there was this map of the American West and you saw your own land on it and many other ranchers on it, and this idea was really developing of uniting Western landowners to embrace conservation values. I mean, how is that going?
Well, I'm very excited. We've been an organized entity for, I think, a little over maybe toward 2 years. Our executive director, Leslie Allison, and her whole team and staff, Rick and Kathleen and Hallie, have just done a great job. We've got excitement. We've got members from southern Arizona and New Mexico all the way to Montana. I'm not quite sure what our total acreage is, but I think Western Landowners Alliance, with its deeded, owned, permitted working lands, is approaching maybe 20 million acres. That'd be, I think, roughly six or so times the size of the core of Yellowstone. So in a couple years, if we've brought 20 million acres of lands together to talk about conservation and their future use and health, I think our goal is 50 million acres of people together. I think we've had probably some really good impacts on landscapes and shared information. And I hope this group can work cooperatively with federal agencies and in Washington to empower many good folks in those agencies to do new and creative things and to not be afraid of trying new things and having a positive spotlight shined on them. And where we as working farms and ranches and landowners and our landowner mix in the Western Landowners Alliance runs from what I think some folks might call amenity ranchers that have guest services and others to farming operations and ranching operations. My ranch just happens to include all of those. I hope we are representing a broad middle-of-the-road spectrum of people that care about healthy, working, biodiverse lands. And if we've accomplished that on 20 million acres in the West, and that many times the size of a glacier or a Yellowstone Park, then I think the future's hopeful.
Now, is it possible for people to visit the High Lonesome Ranch and see what you're up to?
You bet. We think of ourselves as a public landscape. Our gate entrance fee is different, but I think the level of services, accommodations, and the quality of the experience from wildlife to your bed at night exceeds those of most places. So we are open to the public, and if any of your listeners are interested in seeing what we're doing, having a good time, having a good meal, no matter if you've caught a big trout or completed your birding list, our guests are always interested in talking to our scientists, who are usually at the meals, and learning about what we're trying to accomplish on the landscape, what we've learned, what we failed in, and what we hope to achieve. And so I'd certainly welcome you and any of your listeners to the ranch and our website, and also to see and look up what all we're doing. I'm very proud of our Western Landowners Alliance and the growth and the impact and positive influence I hope we have in economic vitalization in the West and conservation.
Paul Valdick is chairman and CEO of the High Lonesome Ranch in Colorado. He's on the board of the Western Landowners Alliance. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for the time today.
The High Lonesome Ranch is on the web at thehighlonesomeranch.com, and the Western Landowners is on the web at westernlandownersalliance.org.